Okay, so let's begin part two of our series of shiurim on Mechiras Chametz. Tonight's shiur is going to be dedicated in memory of Malka Bat Binyamin. Your site is tonight, tomorrow. Neshama should have an aliyah. Quick review just of the highlights of yesterday's shiur for those who weren't here. And to review, also as well for those who were here, we traced the halachic history of Mechirat Chametz. We noted that in the Talmud Bavli, there really is no source whatsoever for the phenomenon that we're familiar with. However, in the Tosefta, there is a version of a Mechira, although that was not exactly what we do, because that was an ad hoc situation, which was an emergency, and it was also a direct sale one-to-one between the person who was selling and the person who was buying. We mentioned that in the 16th and the 17th century, halachic history took a big leap, and we started permitting, because of necessity, a Mechirat Chametz, which was still one-to-one by the buyer and the seller, but the big leap then was that the Mechametz still remained in the physical possession of the non-Jew, and that was obviously halachically quite a big leap. And then finally, we mentioned that at some point, probably at some point in the early part of the 19th century, the Rabbanim realized that it simply wasn't working to have all the private individuals engaging in this sale just for practical considerations, although many were able to be quite capable and fluent in the intricacies of the halacha. Many people weren't, and there just simply were too many mistakes, and therefore the final piece in that puzzle kind of occurred at that part of the early 19th century when communal rabbis started taking the responsibility of selling on behalf of large numbers of people, and obviously we've traveled quite a distance from where we originally began. We spoke about the fact that there needs to be an actual halachic kinyan, a transfer of the chametz from one to the other, and we mentioned that it's not so simple how to perform that kinyan, because even when it comes to buying and selling movable objects between Jews, there's some discussion of whether it's sufficient to just give money, kinyan kesef, does a person have to lift up the object, hakvad, you have to pull the object, mashicha, but we said there's a further debate upon that debate, there's a further debate about what is the particular or the correct kinyan between Jew and non-Jew. And because we're not sure, even in a general sense, but especially in a mitzvah setting where the stakes are so high like chametz, the practice already quoted in Tosfos is to try to be strict. And the Mishnah Berurah says certainly that became the adopted practice when it came to selling chametz. So the last part that I just reviewed briefly, the 35 minutes of the shiur, and then the last 5 minutes of yesterday's shiur, more or less, 7 minutes, we started discussing the insides, behind the scenes, what exactly goes on. And what actually goes on, for someone who would be unaware and unfamiliar, it might seem confusing or maybe even comical, but there's actually a multitude of kinyanim. I don't know if there's any purchase in the halachic universe that has as many kinyanim being done to affect one sale as Mechiras Chametz. And we go through quite a few kinyanim, all based on that, you know, that fear. Sometimes fear is the best motivator, on that fear that maybe one of the kinyanim we're using isn't good. Okay, so let's try another one. We're always trying to be chosh, to worry about, even if there's a minority opinion out there that might discredit a particular kinyan. And I mentioned that is in keeping with a long-standing practice of being neurotic when it comes to chametz. Again, neuroses can be very unhealthy in religion in many contexts, but there is a lot of latitude for that type of attitude and encouragement of that attitude when it comes to chametz in particular. So we mentioned the kesef, the actual money that's given, how we determine what amount of money should be given, we're going to get to shortly. We didn't get to that yet. But the non-Jew in question does give money to the rabbi who's acting on behalf of the people to buy chametz. We spoke about, obviously, there can't be a hagba or a mashicha. There's no chametz there for him to lift up or to take. So that became the problem. What else do we do? So I think the last thing we mentioned yesterday was the kinyan called kinyan agav. The idea that if you're selling real property, something, a house, apartment, or even something that's attached to it, a built-in shelf or something and the like, when that kinyan happens, you can include, by dint of that sale, the movable objects that are resting on that property. And therefore, we also rent out the use for the non-Jew of all the shelves or closet space, etc., where the chametz is resting. And therefore, when that kinyan takes place, by dint of that, automatically, that's a second kinyan we hope will work. Right now, we have two kinyanim. We have the kesef, we have the agav. Why don't we stop there? Because as we mentioned, this is the last thing we said yesterday, not everyone agrees that the Kinyan Agav would work either on a level of Da'araisa or between Jew and non-Jew. So, well, what do we have next? So the next Kinyan that we try to use is what's known, which actually, as I say, in other contexts of your life, you may be most familiar with, and that is what's known as Chalipin. Chalipin is a symbolic barter. In the Rishonim, they speak about something called shava b'shava. That would be really, I'll give you corn and you give me, strawberries or something. But in our halachic experiences, that's more of what we call a symbolic barter. On behalf of me giving you something or obligating something to you, you symbolically trade me for that. You're familiar with that, perhaps, if you remember, if it's not been too long ago, from your chassan's tish, when the chassan makes a kinyan chalipin to accept upon himself the obligations of the ksuba. That's one example. So there, the rabbi, maybe you didn't know what was exactly happening, good Besar HaKdushin hopefully would explain to the people what's happening, but the rabbi is acting on behalf of the kala. You're not making a kinyan with the rabbi. He's not going to be part of your marriage. That's a good and healthy thing. Right? Even if you're close with him, he shouldn't be in your marriage. So he's acting on behalf of the woman there. He's not of the kala, and he is exchanging. You take his pen, and by you taking that symbolically in exchange for that, you're obligating yourself in the chiyuvim of the ksuba. So similarly, we do a chalipin with the non-Jew. We transfer ownership on your behalf of the chametz to him, and we take something from him as a symbolic barter. I don't know what was done in generations past, but in the generation that we live in, all the times, the six times that I was primarily responsible for doing a sale of chametz for hundreds and hundreds of families, so the non-Jew in question who I used to do the mechira with used to give me his cell phone. So what they did before cell phones is a profound question on many levels. So it's also, we can add mechiras chametz to the mysteries of what do they do before cell phones. But in our day and age, I think it's very common, they trade the cell phone and they get the chametz. So that's a third type of kinyan we use. A fourth type of kinyan we do is known as situmta. Situmta is perhaps very, very fascinating. The Gemara in Maseches Bav Metzia on the Ayin Dalid tells us about situmta. Situmta, the origins, the etymology of that word is it refers to a stamp that was placed on a wine barrel. And the Gemara explains that if you're in a society, even a society within a society, a micro-society, if you're in a society in which there is something that is universally accepted and agreed upon, as that clinches the deal, and no one would go back on that, that itself has halachic import. Excellent, David. So in that context, the Gemara says, when they would put that stamp on the barrel, the situmta, so that was the end of the deal. No, if you ever went back on that, you were out of business. That was the deal. So the Mishneh Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan both mention, again, this is going back already a while, but Mishneh Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan already mentioned that in our day and age, often the handshake clinches the deal. Now, there aren't that many subsections of society where a handshake carries that much weight. From my understanding, in the Diamond District, it's still, at least it used to be legendarily, that was the case. The man's handshake, his word was his bond. I hope it's still true there. I don't know if that's really true in any other area of business so far. But just in case, why not? So sure enough, I always used to explain to the fellow I was doing the mechira with exactly how, you look like a trustworthy person. I hope you think I'm a trustworthy person. Well, by me, your word is your bond. And let's shake on it. And we used to shake on it. We used to try to do a form of situmta. I think we're up to four now, or five. A fourth kinyan that we also do is, in addition to doing all this, we write it down. We put it in a contract. We put it in a shtar. Now, this is actually quite interesting because, as the Aruch HaShulchan points out, according to the halacha, shtar is not a valid kinyan for movable objects. Right, so why do we do a shtar? It's not really you can't sell me your Discman or your MP3 player or your iPhone with a contract. That would not be a valid kinyan. Hot or Verizon or whoever you use, they might make the terms of the deal in a contract, but from a halachic perspective, that's not the kinyan. There has to be some other kinyan on it. So why do we have a shtar in Mechiras Chametz? So the Aruch HaShulchan points out one good reason for doing it is that he says that in our day and age, contracts are a way the society recognizes transfer of title. We take things more seriously when they're written down. Not halachically, just that's socially. When you put something in writing, that that reflects a higher degree of seriousness, and in our mind, that really is. Well, did you sign the contract? Right. We even think in those terms. Once you sign the contract, you can't. So says the Aruch HaShulchan. Since even though it's not from a strictly halachic perspective, a legitimate kinyan for something like chametz, but it has the benefit of not only raising the degree of seriousness for the whole sale, which is something that's always haunting us. We mentioned yesterday, we always want to make sure this is done as seriously as possible. But in addition, the Aruch HaShulchan suggests that perhaps the shtar, ironically, is actually a disguised situmta. Because since in today's day and age, people take a contract very seriously, if we use a contract to sell the chametz, so you'll take it seriously, the rabbi takes it seriously, the non-Jew who's in question, who's helping you, will take it seriously. So that's another reason why we would use the contract. One last kinyan to mention before we move on to some of the broader interest issues. One other kinyan that we often will try to use is what's known as chatzer. Now, there's a very, very subtle difference between chatzer and agav. I'm not even sure in this context I would be up to the task of defining exactly the difference. The commonality is as follows. Chatzer, halachically, means your courtyard, your property. Generally speaking, what that means is if you buy someone's property, you buy their backyard, you buy their chatzer, you buy their machsan, you buy their house, unless it's otherwise noted, anything that's in that property is yours. The alternative would be that you were stealing. So generally we assume that something that's in your chatzer is yours. Now, again, that sounds very much like agav. I buy the house, I get the chametz, I get the tractor. Again, there is a discussion of what the difference is, but for our purposes, it's not totally important. Not all of the poskim even mention this. The Mishnah Berurah makes no mention of using a chatzer in Mechiras Chametz, perhaps because the Mishnah Berurah mentioned that we should use agav. But the Mishnah Berurah does not mention it. On the other hand, the Aruch HaShulchan actually does. My practice, again, which I don't know if this is universal, but certainly common in my circles, was to actually also talk about chatzer. We put that in the contract, that was another line in the contract, and there's another thing that I used to explain to him, that in addition, another way you're acquiring the chametz is by chatzer, because all the houses and all the rooms and all the closets and all the shelves are now your property for the duration of the holiday, and therefore, just like anything in your apartment now is yours, obviously you're not a robber, anything in your property is yours, so obviously anything now that you're the owner of the lawful owner of these shelves and closets and the like, that you own that as well. So one of the reasons perhaps why people don't like that is that some of you may be familiar from your time in yeshiva, there's a big discussion exactly how chatzer works. And some suggest it's a kind of a shlichus. So we know that, generally speaking, we can't make a halachic agency between Jew and non-Jew. So to have him have a kinyan through chatzer, chatzer is midin shlichus, again, not to get too lost in the details, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but like everything we've said the 10 minutes today and the last 5 minutes yesterday, Shir, every one of the kinyanim have questions. Okay, that's the bottom line. If the details are too much for you, so the main thing to take out of this is all of the specific methods of kinyan have questions. Each one of them have their strengths. Each one of them have their vulnerabilities. In almost any other context, we'd make a determination what seems to be the best, and we just go with that, and we would leave well enough alone. But that's not the approach to chametz. When it comes to chametz, so we want to dot all of our I's and cross all of our T's, and therefore we throw in 4, 5, 6 kinyanim, all to make sure hopefully we have at least one and ideally at least two that work. One of my rebbeim many years ago pointed out to me, and I think this is a truism probably in other areas of life as well, but we were talking about learning, that when you're learning, Gemara, and you often, have Tosfos ask a question, and then Tosfos gives 2 or 3 answers. So generally speaking, if Tosfos has to give more than one answer, that's already an indication that there's a problem with all of them. Because if one of the answers was self-sufficient, then there would just be one answer. Right? So again, it's true, I know, like for example in parenting, right? When you tell your children to do something or not to do something and they ask why, and you have to start giving more than one reason, right? It's usually because you're treading water on all of them, right? You know you don't want them to do that, or you want them to do that. Like, I don't know. We shouldn't doubt our own convictions, but we don't always have either the best reasons or the kind of reasons that we can explain to our children, as the case may be. So once we start giving multiple reasons, right? Now, as you get older, you realize this, right? And for those of us who are both children and parents, so we have a bird's eye view of this, right? Once you have to give more than one reason, it's probably because there's something a little off, and each reason has its compelling parts, but each reason has its vulnerabilities. So that is for sure true in halacha as well. It's a good rule of thumb when you're learning, and it's also a good rule of thumb in general halachic practice. So we have to do multiple things, so there's a certain implicit acknowledgement that none of them are necessarily foolproof. That's one point you should take from this. The second point you should take from this most recent discussion we've been having is the seriousness with which we go through this process. If we were being not only cavalier, if we were just treating this like a normal halachic transaction, we could be doing away with many of these things. So to kind of compensate for the fact that there is a little bit of a leap halachically, a leap of faith halachically, and perhaps people implicitly are not as serious as they always should be about this, so we compensate by throwing kinyan after kinyan after kinyan, various methods of acquisition in order to bolster this process as much as possible. But the issue of seriousness really is at the heart of this. Rav Henkin, who is a name that's perhaps not sufficiently appreciated in my generation and even among the generation above me, but two generations before that, was really the leading posek in the United States. It kind of was like a gift from Hashem that he gave us, at least those of us in America, he gave us Rav Henkin. And then, as Rav Henkin was getting older, he gave us the baton to hand off to Moshe Feinstein. They both lived actually on the Lower East Side, so there was a certain geographic symmetry as well. And Rav Henkin really was a great genius. Some of our people are familiar with Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin and his wife, Rabbanit Henkin from Nishmat. So Rabbi Herzl Henkin is the grandson of Rabbi Yosef Elio Henkin, but who was really, he was a Talmud of the Aruch HaShulchan, he has smicha from the Aruch HaShulchan. Important to know that, because if you read one of his tshuvas, he mentions that if there's ever a machlokis between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishneh Berurah, he says everyone in Europe knew that the Aruch HaShulchan was a bigger Talmud Chacham than the Mishneh Berurah, and that if there's ever a machlokis, of course you should pass the Aruch HaShulchan. Plus, he says, he was a Rav. He wasn't just Rosh Hashiva, he was a Rav of a community. And he adds, he was the son of a Rav, if I remember correctly. So he had a Mesorah, he had practical experience because he was the Rav, and he was a big Gadol. The only thing he doesn't tell you, it could be that everything he's saying there is 100% true. The only thing he doesn't tell you is, and by the way, I'm a Talmud. If I remember correctly, I don't think that's in the Tshuva. But, okay, anyway, Rav Henkin was a great, great genius and a super-duper tzaddik. And he wrote on a number of things, and between his grandson and others, there have been, in recent years especially, an attempt to kind of bring his writings more to the attention of the public. So one of the things that Rav Henkin mentions in the two-volume work, Kisvei Rav Henkin, in volume number two, he says that, again, I don't exactly know historically how this evolved, but I know that's very common, certainly in my circles and probably, I hope, all of yours nowadays, is that when we do sell the chametz, that we have the chametz, not just haphazardly lying around the house. Right? None of the kinyanim that we said require the chametz to be in a specifically designated place. But nevertheless, says Rav Henkin, we do that. We have the practice of specially designating an area. This is chametz, don't go there, with the red ribbon or some piece of tape or something on those closets or on those shelves, etc. And Rav Henkin says, the reason why we do that? Not because it's per se required, but because it strengthens the level of seriousness among the seller. Anything that we can do, and not that would be mischievous or dishonest, but short of that, anything else that we can do, which will get all of us, you and me, the people who are selling through the rabbi to the non-Jew, to take the process seriously and really, really, in our hearts, believe that I am now selling my chametz, that is absolutely critical, and anything that we can do to encourage that is something that is done. The importance of this is very significant because it's not always, I alluded to this a little bit yesterday, it's not always possible to get someone to buy the chametz who is the most sophisticated or of the greatest means. The more sophisticated the non-Jew is on the side of the table, so the more he can conceptualize when you're talking about these various modes of acquisition and kinyanim, the more serious that makes the process. And the more you know he really has a bank account which could afford this chametz, also makes the chametz, the transaction much more serious. I think I mentioned yesterday that, leave aside the book knowledge, just in practice, one of the most, if not literally the most highly respected and regarded Mechiras Chametz process in the East Coast is Rabbi Willig's in Riverdale. So there's two reasons for that. One is that he's the one selling it on behalf of the Jewish people. But the other is because he had great Seidat HaRishmaya decades ago to find a very sophisticated real estate broker, a non-Jewish person who's happy to do the sale, who understands various abstractions that are discussed during the Mechira. I don't exactly know what his bank account is, but it's somewhat significant. So that he has, whether or not he's the best rabbi, he's got the best guy. if I could be blunt. And it helps make the whole process very seriously. Most shuls, most communities end up doing what I, for example, by no choice, did in Baltimore, and that is they end up selling to the shul janitor. When I got to Baltimore, even though I was taking responsibility for our shul and various other people who would sell through me, which most years is about 300 families, sometimes even more, but there was another rav down the block from me in the Aguda of Greenspring, and Rabbi Mordechai Shachatovitz, who was a big dayan for the Aguda there in Baltimore, as a relative and a close talmid of Rav Ruderman Zatzal. So he used to do the mechira not only for his shul, which was only a modest size shul, but many other people in the community, including the entire Ner Yisrael, used to sell through him. He had many, many hundreds of shtaros that he would bring. So I figured, you know, I'm going to sell on my own. I know, Baruch Hashem, know what to do, but still, I'm happy to do it with somebody else. It was a nice achdus thing. The two of us every year got together on Erev Pesach to sell the chametz. So I asked him, and he was, you know, close to, if not literally, the age of my father, and I wasn't going to start questioning who he's using. So who do you sell the chametz to? So it used to be the janitor. He wasn't even the janitor anymore. Now he's the manager of a small apartment building. But we used to go to this fellow, and we used to go. And once I even remember, we met in the laundry room in the basement of the apartment building. He was manager of at the time. So, you know, you can't always get, you know, the most sophisticated or wealthiest person. So I mention all this because there's a comment of a Shlomo Eger. Shlomo Eger wrote a commentary from the Kiveger family, Gilyon Marsha. And he says, this is very important, and we generally have to rely on this. He says, when the seller, in this case us, the Jewish community, when the seller is serious about the sale, we are not as concerned that the purchaser takes it as seriously. It's ideal when both sides have the same equal level of das. But for the benefit here of us getting it out of our rishus, says the Gilyon Marsha, in this case, as long as we have serious, serious das, we have serious intent on the part of the seller, we're not as concerned as the buyer. And therefore, again, it's not ideal, I admit, but b'dyeved, you know, many, many, many communities, it's certainly, I would say it's far more prevalent than not, that the janitor or some equivalent ends up being a nice, hopefully honest person, but nevertheless, not someone who you'd otherwise be selling what could be hundreds of thousands, if not even more, worth of chametz to. Nevertheless, we end up relying on that. So that's one area, yet again, where the issue of seriousness comes in. A third, so we have the actual kinyonim that we use to make it serious. We have hopefully designating certain places and finding an ideal person to buy from as a realm of seriousness. And a final thing which has become very common in most communities, which is really about bolstering seriousness, is the way you appoint the rabbi. In the Aruch HaShulchan and other people mention, again, similarly to what we saw before, that just like we designate the place of the chametz really for the purpose of seriousness more than anything else, says Aruch HaShulchan, it's very important that when we appoint the rabbi, we do it in as formal and as legalistic a way as possible so that people take that seriously. It doesn't matter how well-versed or how competent the rabbi is or how many kinyonim he uses, and even if he had Donald Trump as the one buying the chametz, it doesn't matter. If you don't take it seriously when you give over the responsibility to the rabbi, so that's like, you know, the baton never got passed. So it doesn't matter. The rabbi might cross the finish line, but if he doesn't have the baton, it doesn't matter. Right? It starts with you, the person who goes to the rabbi, being serious. So the Aruch HaShulchan suggests, and this has really, I think, become common minhag, that we have, you know, every rabbi has their own way of doing it, but we have a form that the individual balabatim fill out where they specify the types of chametz, the location of the chametz, the value of the chametz. Again, some rabbis are incredibly particular. I've seen among good, responsible rabbanim quite a bit of range. I am proud to say I didn't originate anything. I just adopted the shtar and the contract that my Rebbe, Rabbi Willig, used. But I can tell you that not only was this Rabbi Shachatovitz from the Aguda in Baltimore, did he use a different one, but my predecessor in Baltimore, Rabbi Weinreb, used a completely different one, which was far less rigorous and far less specific than the one I used. Nor did I ever cast an ounce of doubt on the way he did it. There's a range of different ways. Some people require more information, some people require less. But generally speaking, I think it's become more and more popular and accepted for Rabbanim to demand that. Again, I repeat, I'm pulling the veil back. It's not really, really necessary. The mechira could work without it. But the reason that we do it, and the reason I think rabbis should do it, is because, correct me if I'm wrong, if you disagree with me, but I think most people will take the process much more seriously when they're forced to think about it, to specify it, to try to give a value to it. And every year people would say, I'm not really sure exactly how much. And I would say, do your best. Make a good faith effort. Don't overvalue it, you know. But whatever you can to try to be as accurate as you can. Try to make a good faith effort. You don't remember exactly where it is. You don't remember exactly how much it's valued. The point was to get people to take this seriously. Again, it's bidyeved, it's not 100% necessary. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he points out that, and again, this is maybe where other rabbanim, including my predecessor, got their Masorah from. Moshe Feinstein says he doesn't really think it's necessary to list all the types of chametz that are being sold. He says, when it was an individual person, if you were going over to your neighbor and selling, so how does he know what he's buying? Of course you have to list the chametz. That Moshe said you have to. But he says, once you're talking about hundreds, thousands of people, obviously the person understands that he's buying a large volume of chametz. You know? Exactly, you know, where your Cheerios are and where your granola bars are, not the biggest deal, says Moshe. So, okay, I'm not questioning that, but I think the reason that the minhag has become to be to do it anyway, notwithstanding that tshuva of Moshe, because I think it gives us a much greater sense of seriousness to the whole process, and that is really prerequisite. Yes?
So if you do allocate a certain, you know, closet, say that's where your the sale is going to take place, and then after Pesach, you found stuff outside of
I can't speak to everyone's contracts. I can only speak for the contract I use and the way I was trained. So we always just specify, even in the Harsha, the contract that I used to sign with the people, and then the contract certainly that I use when I would sit down with an non-Jew, we always used to make the point that it's chametz that are in the designated areas or any property that they own. Because there's a fail-safe, you know, as a fail-safe. Again, the main thing is you're selling your chametz, and you're committing to that on your behalf. The rabbi is selling it. But again, we try to make it as serious as possible. But we try, again, if you have a competent rabbi who knows what he's doing, so you try to, you know, cover all your bases, that notwithstanding.
Two questions. One regarding the rabbi and one regarding the buyer, the non-Jew. Regarding the rabbi, at least I've done this many years, the rabbi gives you the pen, lifts it up. You give it right back to him. So what are you getting for selling your chametz? He didn't give you or any. He doesn't give anybody the pen.
Good.
Or the handkerchief.
Okay. Good.
So that's one question. The other question, you talked about, you know, if optimally, like with Rabbi Willick, you have a buyer who's in a certain ability and a certain financial situation. Fine, but is the buyer actually giving any money?
Yes.
Okay.
So good.
That
yes.
Was never come.
Okay. Okay. I didn't get right. Okay.
Okay.
So two things. That's my father, by the way. He always asks brilliant questions. So, number one, which I was about to get to, good segue. When you most rabbis, I assume this is pretty much universal, when you fill out the documents, whatever you fill out, the rabbi usually has you give a kinyan. You know, again, typically, I used to give people a pen. I think that's pretty common. Many rabbis, certainly in the Hasidic world, they often will give the gartel to lift up. I knew a certain rabbi who liked to take off his yarmulke and give them the yarmulke to lift up. I can't speak. I don't own one. But I'm sure you could do anything. That's the, so the answer to that is as follows. That is something that is relatively symbolic. You don't really need that. You don't really need that, which is why Bidi Eved, the poskim right, by telephone, if you had to, you could appoint. Once, I still remember the year that we were going to this particular guy in the basement of the apartment building that he was the manager of in the laundry room, not me, but the other rabbi I was with, got a phone call. I forgot. Every year somebody forgets at the last minute. That's a klal gadol in life. Not only mechiras chametz, but especially mechiras chametz. There's always one person who waits to the last minute and one person who waits 1 second even longer than that. So this particular person called, and in the end, b'di'evad, we do. The rabbi sat down, he wrote down the information. Where's the chametz? I filled it out. There was no kinyan or anything like that. He did it over the phone. I saw recently there's a well-known and I think well-respected based in Lakewood called Beis Havad. So I get, you know, weekly emails from them. I don't always have a chance to read them, but they all seem interesting and serious. And the most recent one, right before Pesach, was all about you could sell your chametz through them, directly internet. So then they say, if you're going to do that, then you should also call us. I'm not sure why calling is one step above internet. There's not going to be a kinyan either way. The answer is you don't really, really need it. So why do we do it? It's a way of creating what we call in halacha gemiras das. It's all about you taking it more seriously and appointing the rabbi. I think probably comes the popularity of this comes from Rav Soloveitchik, but many of his talmidim, including my rabbi, Rabbi Rosenzweig, always likes to quote the Rambam in the end of Hilchos Mechira, Perek Hei, and the Perek Hei of Hilchos Mechira. The Rambam speaks about there's various things which don't really need kinyan sudar, the suit or lifting up the handkerchief, but people do it anyway. And on the one hand, the Rambam kind of ridicules that. It's a little bit of an amaratus that people are doing these kinyan when they don't need it. It's not only do you not need it, it's not effective. Yet, the Rambam more or less indicates, and this is, I think, where Soloveitchik used to explain it in a very dramatic and forceful way, is that it's nevertheless a good idea, or became the minhag, because at the heart of any kinyan is da'as. Lifting the object, pulling the object, all these things are symbolic ways of conveying the seriousness of the desire to make the purchase or the sale, as the case may be. It's all, in the end, most likely about the das, the intent of the person involved. And therefore, the kinyan sudar is a way of concretizing that commitment. So even if it's not halakhically acquiring or accomplishing anything beyond, at minimum, it creates that level of, I think Rav Rosenzweig likes to call it, the solemnizing presence. He talks about Edekium and this, for those of who have been in the Shir may be familiar with this. But anyway, it creates a certain seriousness, I guess was the most simple way of putting it, which again is really at the heart of this, because the Achilles heel of the whole process is not what it says in any of the books. The Achilles heel is people not taking it seriously. So anything that we can do to take it more seriously, again, if you can't do it, I can bidyevit, I think it would work anyway. That's the phone, the fax, and the internet are proofs of that. What about the buyback? So I mentioned Kinyan Kesef, but my father brought it up, so let me mention that was yesterday, maybe I wasn't as clear. The fellow who you're sitting with does give you money. Now, he doesn't give you thousands and thousands of dollars. I think he used to give us a 20. He does, but he does give you money. You can't have Kinyan Kesef unless he gives you money. So he does, that's one of the Kinyanim. The question is, which I'll relate to now, which is, well, why is that count? If I'm selling thousands of dollars of chametz, you know, that's a pretty serious discount that you're giving him if you give it to him only for $20. So I'll relate to that question as I relate to a second question, which is something which no one thinks about, which is the Motzi Pesach. Right? Just, I'm not speaking now autobiographically since I'm not currently in the active pulpit rabbinate, but all of you, wherever you come from, I assume have shul rabbanim, and I'm always a big fan of you having as much respect for them and as sympathy for them. So whatever it is that you are doing, especially those of you who are at home for Pesach, are doing on Motzei Pesach, the rabbi has to do all those things also, but he's not. Because the rabbi, after he says a quick hello to his family, says Abdallah, is quickly running out to do the Mechiras Chametz again, to buy back the Chametz so you can have it. And then you can go to Friendly's or wherever else you're going to go, or Dunkin' Donuts or anything like that. So you should be great, very appreciative of your abundant, more dedicated and hardworking for you. So there is this other thing which no one thinks about, which is Motzei Pesach, when the rabbi is buying back the Chametz. Now, these two things go together. The Bir Halacha already, the Mishnah Berurah, points out that obviously, you know, even a non-Jew who's very wealthy is not necessarily prepared to give you, you know, thousands of dollars or a greater sum. So we don't have to. We don't view it as a discount. That would be probably a joke. Come on, $20 for all this? But we do view it as a down payment. That works in any other area of life. There's no reason. And the rest is carried over as a debt. Yeah, and basically what we tell them, again, I only know the Masorah that I have, but what we write and what we tell them is, you're paying for it now. We have not come, we estimated the value, which we give him the sheets. All those sheets you give the rabbi, I gave over to him. I give over to him in the first comments. We estimated the value. You're welcome to look at any of them and get a sense of that. But we will agree to meet back at the end of Pesach, at which time he has all the decision. I have no power over him. He has the decision whether he wants to come to an agreement about what the remaining requirement will be or not. And if he says yes, there's nothing I can do about it. It's his already. We make it clear. It's very clear in the contract. He owns it. He owns it from Erev Pesach. But we will clinch the deal and we'll decide, not the deal, the deal is clinched. We will conclude the payment part of the process at the end. If he wants to sell it, then either we will have to agree just bilaterally about what the price should be, or we will go to a group of three experts, neutral experts, who will give an evaluation of all the chametz, and then we will come up with a price. Obviously, the assumption is that he's not going to want to do anything like that, and he'll want to sell the chametz back to us. So then what we do is we buy it back from him with consideration for all the money that he owes us. We can forgive that, and then we buy that back from him. So he's made that money more or less back. You can give a little bit more if you want to create a certain extra level of seriousness, but probably not really necessary. But in essence, the money that the rabbi is paying to buy it back is more or less, again, it's not also small. It's not only did you gave me $20, and you owe me some untold amount of thousands in agreement for me forgiving that and paying you the 20 or the 40 or the 50, will you sell it back to me? And that's a new transaction. We don't have time to get into all the details now, but Shlomo Kluger was a great and brilliant and creative thinker. So he has a big, big discussion. He put a lot of attention into this, the buyback process. And he mentioned that it wasn't always being done. Again, we saw in the evolution of the halachic process here at Mecheres Chometz, there was a lot of steps to this. So one of the steps which we didn't really do enough justice to was the buyback process. And he mentions that even after a lot of work was done to make the sale originally really effective halachically, he found a lot of problems with the way, I guess, various communities were doing the buyback. And he very much stresses, and this is also the opinion of the Mishneh Berurah, and again, in the circles that I traveled in, I think this is the universal practice, is that we do a completely new transaction. He owns the chametz completely. He has an outstanding debt that he owes us thousands and thousands of dollars, but it's his chametz. So the only way to get it back from him is to buy it back if he agrees. I just mentioned, to talk about seriousness, I mentioned yesterday that the first Mecheres Chometz that I witnessed and did a little shimush under was in the Yom Gezer of Staten Island with Rabbi J. Marcus. So I remember, and I was just recollecting with his son Chaim before Yontif, I remember this is close to 20 years ago, him telling us that whoever used to, I'm not sure if it was a neighbor or a janitor that he used to go through all these contracts every year and find at least one or two that looked really good. And he would knock on the door. And the people would always run to Rabbi Marcus. So he's coming. And you say, well, it's his, isn't it? Yeah. And if it's not, then okay. But then retroactively, you were just over in Isser D'oraisa. Now, if you are lucky enough to get somebody like that, that, you know, that's a fine. He added, I could never tell if this was serious or sarcastic, but I'll never forget him telling me that one year over Pesach, unfortunately, one of the families had a fire, and the non-Jew filed an insurance claim for all of his chametz that was burnt in the... So I couldn't tell if he was being serious or not, but I remember him telling us that. Anyway, the point is, that's a rabbi's best friend, is a non-Jew like that, because everyone there understood, even if it was only one person per year, but you were one guy came into shul each year saying, he knocked on my door. And that helped a community of hundreds and hundreds of people. Yes, quickly, because we're running out of time.
No, I was going to say, so presumably, if you haven't sold it to the janitor, and you've sold it to the real estate broker, and he says, hey, I like that property...
Again, you're not selling the house. You're selling the right to use those floors or whatever. This is not a sale of a $500,000 house for the $20. Yes. No, it's the chametz and the parts of the property where the chametz is. Okay, very good. Anyway, again, the bottom line is there still would have to be, and even if he was the house, so then when we'd get our adjusted price or our neutral observers, experts would come up with a price, then they'd come up with a price. It was in the millions then. And whatever it is, it's again, even though the only money that transfers hands could be in the 20s or the $50 range, or something. I mean, typically, that's what I'm familiar with. But it's being done to affect, if it's legally sound, which I believe, if it's legally sound, it has got the same mechanisms that could carry a deal for millions of dollars. And it, even though, at the moment, only a small amount has changed hands. We just have 5-6 minutes left. So I mentioned,
halachically, if a buyer gives a down payment for anything, does title transfer to him
yes.
right away?
Yes. I mean, it depends on the nature of the deal, but it certainly can, absolutely.
Halachically, it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, unless you arrange the deal that it shouldn't. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the answer to that question is yes. And that is what we do in the Mecheres Chometz, according to the Mishneh Berurah. So one or two miscellaneous issues, and then maybe with a nice Musar thought to conclude this two-part series. So number one, what about time zone issues? Many of you are here from one time zone, and now you're for Pesach in a different time zone. So Pesach is going to end earlier in Israel than it is if you're anywhere west of Israel, and vice versa, obviously, if you were traveling either within America or within Europe or from Israel to the States. So this is a discussion. Moshe Feinstein, others discuss this. I think, generally speaking, we go by the place of the owner. Moshe tries to be machmir for both, but I think the general practice, we go by the place of the owner. So, for example, even though I'm in Baltimore, as the case was in my situation, where I would sell a chametz, I always had a certain handful of people who either were going to Israel or going to California or, relatives in Chicago or the like. And we always used to specify, that was more orally than in writing, but both when I sold chametz and when I bought the chametz back, I specified with the non-Jew that there are people have certain time zone issues, and this the deal is taking place at this and such time for everyone except for anyone who happens to be in the West Coast, and they're allowed a few more hours to eat the chametz because or else they might be stealing. And obviously, if people are in Israel and the like, I don't want anyone to be over on Bal Yeroh if they haven't sold the chametz yet, but Pesach ended early. So we do try to accommodate that, at least orally, but that is something to keep in mind, that we do have to keep that in mind, and we usually go by where the person is, at least as much as where the chametz is. A last issue which applies in, again, I don't know how much this was fought out in other places, whether Israel or Europe, but in America, a huge issue in the generation right after the Holocaust, which ended up being really known as the Machlokas and Rav Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik, was what about big supermarkets or businesses that are owned by Jews who still plan on staying open over Pesach. So on the one hand, you want them to sell their chametz, because if it works, we want to save them from averas. But more importantly, a topic which is not at all ours at all is the halacha of chametz shear lava Pesach. If it's a big supermarket chain in your neighborhood and it's owned by Jews and they didn't sell their chametz, so no one's allowed to get to use that supermarket, use that chametz for could be weeks, so who knows how long after Pesach until all of that that stuff is sold. So that's a big practical problem. So despite the obvious vulnerabilities and questions that one could have, Rav Moshe Feinstein does have some tshuvas where very, very, very bidyeved and with clenched teeth, Rav Moshe is matir, doing a mechiras chametz with a non-Jewish store owner who you know has every intention of staying open and selling chametz on Pesach, even though 4 days earlier, 5 days earlier, he quote-unquote sold his chametz. Rav Soloveitchik did not buy it, and in fact, the OU has a process that anything's under the shkach of the OU does not allow it, based on the psak of Rav Soloveitchik. But in many communities, this is relied on with the authority of Rav Moshe, because it's really almost an untenable situation in a certain sense if you don't rely on this. Okay, we have 2 minutes left, I think. So just a very brief, I think a nice musser to end with is a thought that I saw from my very dear and close friend, Rabbi Daniel Feldman. It was a significant Talmud Chacham, in Halacha in particular, but he mentioned something in Musar, which I think is very beautiful. At one point, which I think I don't need to stress anymore, because I've repeated it multiple times over the last 2 days, is how seriously this has to be taken, how Halacha takes this seriously. To say that there's some element of gimmick here, I think, is just admitting the obvious. But that gimmick, quote-unquote, to help all of us in our various situations, is the difference between being a gimmick that doesn't work and a gimmick that does work. There's a huge gulf in between those two things. Halacha does all the effort, has worked out over the last 200 years, everything it needs to work out, I think. You can always improve things, but for the most part, things have been worked out pretty sophisticatedly to make the halachic process as tight and as real as possible. The only thing that's always a question every year is how seriously the people take it, because nothing happens without the people taking it seriously. And if a person really doesn't believe in it, then they shouldn't use it, because it really doesn't work. So you're not fooling anybody or gaining anything. The last point, which I thought was very beautiful, that Rabbi Feldman mentioned, is something that is as follows. Perhaps one of the things that has evolved through the spiritual ingenuity of the Jewish people is we've made a statement about our business ethics and our honesty. Because in essence, what we have here, and again, without repeating everything we saw yesterday, but this was a huge leap in halachic history, when we allowed the mechiras chametz to go through, even though the chametz is staying in our house, in our closet, in our barn. Well, what's to stop the Jew for 8 days or 7 days, as the case may be, from taking that food? Only one thing. A belief in the halachic process that now this is no longer mine, this belongs to a non-Jew. The fact that we therefore stay away from that, the same way more or less that we have this halacha of bitul chametz, right? Bitul chametz basically means it's ownerless, it's not mine anymore. So many have pointed out, even before Rabbi Feldman, that there's a certain overlap between the way bitul works according to some Rishonim, that it's ownerless, and what Mechiras Chametz, in essence, is trying to do, that we don't own it. By us staying away from that Chametz, he suggested, I thought, very nice, al derech hadrush. So by us staying away from that Chametz and treating it, we taking it seriously, treating it as if it's not ours, and therefore we can't touch it. Why can't we touch it? Not because it's Chametz. We can't touch it because it's not ours. And what Jew would touch any money that doesn't belong to him? Right, so that is a statement, again, that we don't always think about it. That's why I'm mentioning it. But the idea that we take halacha seriously, that we believe in the mechanism that the Rabbanim have devised for us, and therefore we don't touch it, because A, it's chametz, but B, because if we believe in it, it's not ours. And we're honest people, we would never touch anything that's not ours. So that's an additional benefit, I think, to going through the process and faithfully observing these halachos. Good morning to all.